Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We're currently working our way through the book of Revelation in our study of eschatology. Visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
See, my favorite part, since we were just talking about the Phil Valentine thing before the internet people joined us, my favorite part of the Phil Valentine thing was not only the amount of positive email I got, and I did get a lot of good email from both friends and strangers, but the most consistent thing I heard was, you didn't come across like a nut job, or you didn't come across like a religious wacko. And people were like pleased with that, you know, oh, you didn't sound like a nut when you were on there. And I was just talking to Carol about it out front here. And I said, isn't that a strange thing that whenever anybody says, well, it's going to be a pastor talking or it's going to be a Christian talking, the first thought people have is, oh, I hope he's not a nut. Oh, what if he's crazy? I said, I don't think there's any other profession where people make that leap. If Phil had said, you know, and next we're going to have the ambassador from Uganda on, nobody would go, oh, I hope he's not a nut, you know, or we're going to have the president of a bank on. Oh, I hope he's not a whack job. Only preachers. Only if they say, we're going to have a preacher on, some kind of Christian leader, we're going to have him on, and people go, oh, I hope he's not a nut. I was glad that at least the responses I got were, hey, you didn't sound like a nut at all. You're quite intelligent. And who'd have thought that? Intelligent Christians. What a novel concept. No one would have expected that. Yeah, that's exactly it. So, Revelation 21. I'm going to run the risk one more time tonight of coming right on the verge of beating a dead horse. Because one more time here in Revelation 21, we're going to have to talk about Israel. It's just inescapable. I know that by now everybody in this room pretty much has that sense of, okay, we get it, Jim. The book of Revelation is a heavy-duty Israelitish book. Lots of Jewish references. Clearly John, who was an apostle to the Jews, in writing this letter, clearly had a very Jewish mindset as he was writing. All these references are so clearly references to Israel. And the only reason I'm going to sound like the repetitionist I am tonight is because the text is that repetitious. Tom's nodding, and yes, the text is so repetitious with these concepts that I think we're just fooling ourselves if we ignore all those repetitions or try to say, well, they don't mean anything. The repetitions are in the text on purpose. And one more time, as we look at the New Jerusalem tonight, one more time, we're going to be forced to see that it is connected, inextricably connected, not just to the southern kingdom, Judah, but to the 12 tribes of Israel. And they're going to be named. And so we're not only going to look at that tonight, but we're going to look at the history of God's particularity in naming the 12 tribes of Israel back in Exodus when he's first establishing them as a nation. And you're going to see the connection, connections that nobody argues with when you're looking at Exodus. And yet, when you've got John, the apostle, to the circumcision, one of the three, Peter, John, and James, who stayed in Jerusalem and led the Jerusalem church, when he, of all people, writes about Israel in the book of Revelation and says 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes, and then names them by name, that's the point at which people go, well, that can't mean that. But in Exodus, if they're named by name, you go, well, that means the 12 tribes of Israel. In Exodus, clearly, 12 tribes of Israel, they're named by name. And then you have a Jewish apostle to the circumcised believers, one of the leaders of the Jerusalem church, say 12 tribes of Israel, name them by name, and people go, nope, doesn't mean that. Well, here's going to be another one of those places where the amillennialist or the church replacement theologian really, really has to do some fancy tap dancing because the text is going to say one more time, just as plainly as it can, that when the New Jerusalem arrives, it's all about Israel. You will notice as we read through this that even though it refers to the bride of the Lamb or the Lamb's wife at this point, which is really interesting language, we'll get to that in a moment too, even though there's this reference to the one that is married to the Lamb, which we would say, okay, that's the church, it does not do away with the references to Israel, to the 12 tribes, to the apostles ruling over the 12 tribes. All of that is still intact despite the fact that the church exists. So the church replacement theologian obviously has a lot of work to do to prove that theology is valid when you look at the text. Okay?
Yep.
All introduction. And I'm tired tonight, so technically it does count against my time, all right? It's the first time I've ever said that. I know I don't mean to set a precedent, but that counted against my time. And oh, fine. Chapter 21, let's start at verse 1, and we'll just read, we'll build up speed until we get to verse 9, which is where the new information begins. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle or the dwelling of God is with men, and he will dwell with them. They shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said unto me, It is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and the murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Then starting at verse 9, there came unto me one of the seven angels which had the seven vials full of the seven last plagues. And he talked with me, saying, Come hither, and I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. Now, this is really interesting language, because throughout the New Testament, the church is spoken of as the bride of Christ. Paul writes and says, I betroth you as a chaste virgin. So the language of the church is always as they that are betrothed to the Lamb. But here you see, for the first time, the bride called the Lamb's wife. Why would that be? We've already seen the marriage supper of the Lamb. If you've seen the marriage supper of the Lamb, then the marriage to the Lamb has already happened. Therefore, the church is already not only married, but is the Lamb's wife at this point. So all of that marriage supper stuff that we saw before chapter 20, back in chapter 19, the marriage supper of the Lamb, which happened before chapter 20, which is the millennium passages. And so now, at the end of the 1,000 years, after the church ruling and reigning with Christ for 1,000 years on earth, then you finally see New Jerusalem coming. And New Jerusalem obviously contains the church, who is now called the Lamb's wife. Now, if that was all it said, if it stopped at, here comes the New Jerusalem, and it's referred to as the Lamb's wife, then the church replacement theologians can at least say, New Jerusalem is the church and the church alone. And since it's clearly just the church, a mixture of Jews and Gentiles, all believers of all time, then there's clearly no more Israel, no more need for Israel, no more necessity of Israel. But if at the end of the 1,000 years, God is still making references to the 12 tribes of Israel, then we have to conclude, whether you're amillennial, whether you're premillennial, any view you take, if you say once the new heaven and earth starts, and New Jerusalem is established on earth, if New Jerusalem makes direct reference to the 12 tribes, then you've got to say that the 12 tribes continued throughout the millennium until they reached the new heavens, new earth. Is that logical enough? So even if you're amillennial and you say, well, once Jesus comes back, the judgment happens instantaneously, new heavens, new earth, that's still not a good excuse to say that God is done with the 12 tribes of Israel, because they are inextricably connected with the New Jerusalem. And of course, as we saw, Isaiah said that as long as the new heavens and the new earth were, that's how long Israel would remain. So new heavens, new earth, tied to the longevity of Israel, all 12 tribes, and the New Jerusalem, tied to the 12 tribes of Israel. Again, you've just got to be purposefully thick-headed to not see those connections and then say those connections are clearly trying to tell us something. I do not understand how people can read what we're about to read and still conclude that the amillennial church replacement theology is valid. God clearly has a continuing plan for Israel, but not just the southern tribes, not just the Jews. People are watching what's happening in the Middle East right now, and they're seeing the anti-Jewish sentiment rising up again. They're seeing the Islamic movement against Israel nationally and the Jews in particular, and they're saying, well, that's a fulfillment. See, that's a fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And the place that they're missing it, and they're very close to it, I mean, clearly this is a forerunner to it. Clearly we're all looking at the Middle East again and watching Israel and Jerusalem and bombs in Nazareth, and when they talked about they bombed Caesarea and on the Sea of Galilee. I mean, you're hearing all these Bible words on the news every night now. All these Bible places, all these locations where Jesus walked is where bombs are falling right now. But the place where you've got to be really careful and where the prophecy extremists are kind of going crazy right now is you've got to see that difference between the southern tribes, the Judahites, the tribe of Benjamin and Judah that make up the southern kingdom, northern kingdom, 10 tribe people were never identified as Jews, never called Judahites. And yet they have a continuing role to play in the millennium and in the New Jerusalem. So it's not just about the Jews. It's not just about the southern kingdom or the southern two tribes. It's about collective 12 tribes. And so, come hither and I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. Verse 10. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain, and he showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, and her light was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. Now, I got an email once from a person who said, how is it then that the bride of Christ can be identified as New Jerusalem? I thought the church was the bride. How is Jerusalem the bride? If the bride, the Lamb's wife, is New Jerusalem coming down, and then it says, come hither, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife, and then what he shows them is New Jerusalem coming down out of the heaven. What's the connection there? I think the connection is, do you remember when Jesus was crying out to the leaders of Jerusalem and saying, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kill the prophets, how often I would have gathered your children as a mother hen gathers her chicks, but you would not. He referred to the inhabitants of Jerusalem as Jerusalem, but he was talking to the people, the leaders of Jerusalem. Understand that? When he said, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, he wasn't talking to the city walls. He was talking to the leaders of the city who were resisting everything that Christ had come to accomplish and preach. And so I think that's exactly what you're seeing here. It is the church that is in the New Jerusalem, that is the bride, that is coming down from heaven to earth, and so the church can be called the bride and the New Jerusalem. And again, if that was all the language we had to describe New Jerusalem, then yes, we could say the church has now become Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the church. Therefore, we can do away with all that Israel language. The problem is the next verse, verse 12. And it had a great wall and very high, and it had 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Uh-oh. Now, as soon as you see that, then you have to conclude, because it's impossible to avoid, that there have to still be Israelites when the New Jerusalem arrives. How do you get from 12 gates with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel on it, how do you get from that to, oh, that means the church? That's an enormous leap. Now, of course, the leap typically is to say, well, she's called the bride. Jerusalem is called the Lamb's wife. And the church is the bride of Christ, who at the marriage supper of the Lamb is married to the Lamb, and so New Jerusalem coming down out of the sky is identified as the Lamb's wife. So clearly the church, the Lamb's wife, New Jerusalem, that's the replacement right there. And never in any church replacement book I've ever read do they ever go on to verse 12. They all stop at verse 12 because they're afraid of that. Verse 12 blows the theory completely and says that on the 12 gates are written the 12 names of the 12 tribes. Now, I can't read that without it forcing me to go back to Exodus 28. So go back there. And let's see if we don't find a precursor to this very thing. Exodus 28, when God is establishing Israel as a nation, the united 12 tribes, and handing out the law, and telling, this is very, very important, telling Moses the way that the priest has to be dressed when he goes into the Holy of Holies to make atonement for the people of Israel. We're talking about how the priest approaches God to make atonement for God's people. Exodus 28, take thou unto thee Aaron thy brother and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office. Even Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. Why did Aaron get to be the first priest?
All I know is he was Moses' brother.
That's right. There's no reason. That's the point. Why did he get to be the first priest? God chose him. God just chose him to be the first priest. He said, take from among the children of Israel this guy, your brother, and make him the high priest, and his sons after him. Why was Moses chosen? Yeah, there's no why. That's the point. God chose him. There were a whole lot of Israelites, and God had said that they'd be there for 400 years, and then a deliverer would come. And Pharaoh became hip to that fact and decided to drown all the firstborn of that generation of Israel. And God floated Moses right into Pharaoh's household. Picked that one. Lots of babies died. Lots of babies were drowned. And Moses floated right into Pharaoh's household because God chose Moses. Now you've got God telling Moses, okay, now Aaron's going to be the high priest. In other words, he chose him. That's important because later, Christ, who is our high priest, who does make intercession for us, is called God's elect. He's the elect one. He's the chosen one. And so God starts prefiguring that right away here with Aaron, who's going to be the first mediator to stand between God's chosen and God and mediate for them. The question is, when Aaron goes in to the Holy of Holies with a blood sacrifice to make atonement for God's people, does he go in there and atone for all the people on planet Earth, or does he atone for particular people? Particular people. This one isn't hard because we know that it was only Israel. He doesn't go in and atone for anybody except Israel. Starting at verse 2. And you will make holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty. And you will speak unto all that are wise-hearted, whom I have filled with the spirit of wisdom, that they may make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office. And these are the garments which you shall make: a breastplate and an ephod, and a robe and a broidered coat, a mitre and a girdle. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office. And they shall take gold and blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen. Why do those four colors jump out at you? They should. Gold, blue, purple, scarlet. Those are the same four colors that are all the way through the tabernacle in the wilderness. Those four colors. And I believe those four colors correspond to the four gospels you find in the New Testament. But we won't get into that right now. It's also, by the way, as you walk through this building, the four colors, the walls are painted. Just thought I'd point that out. Verse 6, and you shall make an ephod of gold, of blue, of purple, of scarlet, and fine twined linen with cunning work. It shall have two shoulder pieces thereof that are joined at the edges thereof, and so it shall be joined together. Now follow this. You're going to create two shoulder pieces that are joined together. They're going to sit on the high priest's shoulder. There's going to be a burden on the high priest's shoulders as he walks in before me. and the curious girdle of the ephod, which is upon it, shall be of the same, according to the work thereof, even of gold and blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen. And you will take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the children of Israel, six of their names on one stone and six of their names on the other stone, according to their birth, and you will engrave them, and they're going to end up resting on those shoulder pieces. So when he walks in, what's the burden on his shoulders when he goes to sacrifice?
Israel,
the 12 tribes of Israel, engraved and burdened on his shoulders when he walks in. With the work of an engraver in stone, like the engraving of a signet, you shall engrave the two stones with the names of the children of Israel, and thou shalt make them to be set in the ouches of gold. And thou shalt put the two stones upon the shoulders of the ephod, for the stones of memorial unto the children of Israel, and Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord upon his two shoulders for a memorial. So the first thing, when the high priest goes in to make atonement, the first thing God's got to see when he looks down is that he has a white turban on that has an engraving in gold on the forehead that says holiness to the Lord. And the next thing he sees is these two stones engraved on either shoulder that has the names in order of the children of Israel on it. Now, when you read that, do you have any question about who we're talking about? No, it's the 12 tribes of Israel, right? So when we're in Exodus and we read it, we go, 12 tribes of Israel. It says right there, 12 tribes of Israel. So then why, when you go to the book of Revelation, and it says 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel, and names them by name, why at that point does the 12 tribes of Israel no longer mean 12 tribes of Israel? It means that in Exodus, when the high priest goes in to make the atoning work, to make the atonement work, one of those two sentences is correct. Why doesn't it mean it then when New Jerusalem comes down and the names of the 12 tribes of Israel are engraved on the gates? When it's engraved on the stones here, God is very specific. These are God's instructions to Moses, write the names in order of the 12 tribes of Israel. And we all agree who he's talking about. But when God sends New Jerusalem to planet Earth at the end of everything, new heaven, new earth, and New Jerusalem comes down, that very same God writes the names of the 12 tribes of Israel on the 12 gates. Am I beating this to death enough yet? Are you getting a sense of this? Are you getting a feel for this? There's simply no good logical, exegetical way to say that in Exodus here, it means the 12 tribes of Israel, the actual historic 12 tribes. But in the New Jerusalem, when those same names are named, over there somehow it means something else. It means the church. But you're dealing with the same God using the same names to designate the same people. You got to give me some real heavy evidence to convince me that what God meant in Revelation 20, 21, is different than what God meant in Exodus 28. So keep reading. Starting at verse 13. And you will make two ouches of gold and two chains of pure gold at the ends. Of wreathed work shalt thou make them, and fasten the wreathed chains to the ouches. And thou shalt make a breastplate of judgment with cunning work. With the work of the ephod thou shalt make it, of gold and blue and purple and scarlet, and a fine twine linen you will make it. Four square it shall be. Now follow this. Four square, what does that mean? Perfect square. Yeah, perfect square. One of the things you're about to see when we get to New Jerusalem is that it is a perfect cube. It's four square. And it has the names of the 12 tribes of Israel engraved on it. You will make a breastplate of judgment with cunning work. Verse 16, four square it shall be, being doubled. A span shall be the length thereof, and a span shall be the breadth thereof. And thou shalt set in it settings of stones, four rows of stones. The first row shall be a sardis, a topaz, and a carbuncle. This shall be the first row. So what we're talking about is four rows of three stones for a total of?
12.
Thank you to the math genius in the corner. The second row shall be an emerald, a sapphire, and a diamond. The third row, a ligur, an agate, and an amethyst. The fourth row, a beryl, and an onyx, and a jasper, and they shall be set in gold in their enclosing. And the stones shall be with the names of the children of Israel, 12 according to their names, like the engraving of a signet, everyone with his name, they shall be according to the 12 tribes. So not only are the 12 tribes of Israel like stones as a burden on the shoulders of the one going in to make the intercession, but they are also engraved in gold over his heart as precious stones. Do you get the symbol? Do you get the feel for it? So when that high priest goes into the Holy of Holies, who's he standing there as a mediator for?
Israel
and nobody else. Their name is all over him, engraved on his shoulders and in gold over his heart. That's who he's there to atone for. Now, I can't help it. That is particular atonement. That's very, very particular atonement. The whole world didn't get atoned for. The high priest went in and atoned for particular people. And never in the Bible do you read that the work of the high priest or the office or the intention of the office of the high priest ever changed in God's mind. The high priest always atoned for particular people. God's chosen. So when Jesus is called the high priest of our profession in the New Testament, especially in the book of Hebrews, written to Hebrews, when they read high priest, they don't think, oh, universal atonement. They are naturally going to read, oh, a high priest who goes in with names on his shoulders and names and precious stones over his heart, and he goes in and atones for God's particular chosen people. And that never changes. Now, back to Revelation 21. Starting at verse 12. The New Jerusalem had a great wall and high, and it had 12 gates. And the gates had 12 angels and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. On the east, 3 gates. On the north, 3 gates. On the south, 3 gates. On the west, 3 gates. Now, how many stones were in a row on the gold breastplate that was 4 square?
3.
Same thing you've got laid out here. Same God laying out the same floor plan. Verse 14. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations. And in them, the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. That's fascinating to me. Because the foundations are the 12 apostles, which means the teaching that the 12 apostles carries still continues to act as the foundation of everything that leads to the New Jerusalem. I mean, the implications are huge there. Turn, if you would, real quickly to Matthew 19. Somebody turn over there real quick. Because Jesus actually promised his 12 apostles that they were going to have this sort of authority. Matthew 19, let's say 27 to 30. Anybody want to read it?
Hello.
Okay, got to read it loud.
Then Peter answered and said to him, "See, we have left all and followed you. Therefore, what shall we have?" So Jesus said to them, "Assuredly, I say to you, that in the regeneration, when the Son of Man sits on the throne of his glory, you who have followed me will also sit on the 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake shall receive 100-fold and inherit eternal life."
Okay, now, let me ask a couple quick questions then. Did Jesus just refer to the regeneration? What do we think the regeneration is he spoke of there? What's regeneration mean? Yeah, resurrection. Yeah. In the resurrection to life, which the Jews were all looking forward to. In the regeneration, the resurrection, which will be marked by the fact that the Son of Man is going to sit on his throne. He said, when the resurrection comes, you will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, then it certainly sounds like Jesus thinks that once the resurrection happens, new heavens, new earth, all that kind of stuff happens, that the 12 tribes are still going to be extant, existing, findable. And the 12 apostles are going to rule over them. So isn't it interesting then that the New Jerusalem would have the 12 gates that had the names of the 12 tribes, and the foundations would be the 12 apostles? Is that very much like what Jesus was describing here? That those two were going to continue. The apostles continue into the regeneration and have authority, be the foundation. And the 12 tribes were going to exist into the regeneration, into the resurrection. So this again is so consistent. You've got Jesus saying that in the resurrection, the 12 extant tribes. You've got all the way back into Exodus, the particularity of the 12 tribes. And then you get into the book of Revelation, 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. And then you get into new heavens, new earth, new Jerusalem, 12 gates, 12 tribes. I can't help how redundant that is. But it's God that's being redundant. It's God's word that keeps saying the same thing over and over again. I know at this point I'm preaching to the choir. I get it. I know that everybody in the room is going, Jim, I'm so convinced. Let it go, move on. But I'm preaching verse by verse through the text. And the text keeps saying these same redundant things over and over because God's trying to tell us something. Which is that if you say the 12 actual physical, historic, national tribes of Israel are over with, then you're talking exactly contradictory to the whole corpus of Scripture. Yes?
The other reference that I was looking at was in Ezekiel, and you're talking about how Ezekiel describes the city and the temple and everything.
Right.
In Ezekiel, it does name, per name, the exact tribes that are listed on which, you know, stones, on
yep.
which walls. So,
right.
I mean, that's so obvious.
Yeah, and that's Ezekiel's temple that hasn't been built yet. The 12 tribes are all named on it. So I can't conclude anything else because of the preponderance of evidence. I can't conclude anything except that God knows who they are and where they are, and he has every intention of regathering them. It's one of the hallmarks of the end times. And so, verse 15, and he that talked with me had a golden reed to measure the city and the gates thereof and the wall thereof, and the city lies four square. Gee, where did we just see that? Same God working the same plan. He's asking you to make the connections. Connect the dots. The city lies four square. The length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city with a reed, 12,000 furlongs. And the length and the breadth and the height are all equal. And he measured the wall thereof, 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of an angel, or the angel who was doing the measuring. So I found this. I thought this was good. I found a fellow who took the time to figure out what those measurements would be like. And I don't know what your different translations have. We've lost some of this sense, I think, of cubits and furlongs and such. But he concludes that that is 1,500 miles. Anybody else got that?
1,500.
What have you got?
I've got 1,400.
1,500? You've got 1,500 in your notes? Here's what that would look like. 1,500 miles is the distance from New York City to Dallas. That gives you a sense of how big this is going to be. But again, we're talking about new heaven, new earth, different than the current earth where there's no sea. So you've got enough land to be building these sort of things. So the distance from New York City to Dallas, the city is a perfect cube. So if you make a box with Minneapolis, Minnesota as the northeast corner, Seattle, Washington as the northwest corner, San Diego, California as the southwest corner, and Little Rock, Arkansas as the southeast corner, then you would have a picture of how big that city would be just in the basic level landmass. But then you got to go up that far. So that would be the four corners and then go up.
That's a high rise.
That's a high rise, yes. A 1,500-mile high, wide, long city would equal 3,375,000,000 cubic miles. Such a city could accommodate 1 billion believers, and each could have a 14,000-square-foot apartment with room left over. That's big. Yeah. Now, think about Jesus saying as he was leaving, I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am you may also be. If it were not so, I would have told you, in my Father's house,
wow,
there are many dwelling places. King James says many mansions, which 14,000 feet, that's enough room. That's what he's talking about. He's saying, I'm going to prepare a place for you, and I will come again and take you, so that where I am you may also be. We're going to New Jerusalem. That's the goal. The ultimate goal of Christianity, as I said last week, is not get a cloud, get a harp. It is ultimately dwelling in the New Jerusalem with God. And now a little description of what that life will be like. Verse 18, the building of the wall was as jasper, and the city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. Can you imagine gold that shiny? The foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third of chalcedony. The fourth an emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth a topaz, the tenth a... Anybody want to take a shot at that? Chrysoprasus? The 11th, a jacinth, and the 12th, an amethyst. Why 12?
12,000
tribes. Yeah, I mean, and these are the foundation stones. Look at how he writes it. He says, these are the foundations. The foundations of the wall of the city are garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation with this, the second foundation with that, the third foundation with that. So the foundation stones are the precious stones, just like the precious stones that were in gold in the four square breastplate that went over the heart. How do you not draw these connections? Connect the dots, folks. God was typifying in the high priest who went in each year for particular people. He was typifying New Jerusalem on the man's chest. God had a plan here for his people. And he's been saying it for a long time. And the one consistent feature all the way back to Exodus 28 to the very end of the Bible is the 12 tribes. That's the only consistent feature. Yes, the church gets added in there. Yes, Gentile believers by grace added in. But they're not the consistent element. Where is the church? Where are the Gentiles back when Aaron is going in to do the atoning work? Where are the Gentiles? Nowhere. They're not part of it. The only consistent element of the whole of Scripture and the redemptive story, the historic redemptive history of God's work on planet Earth, the only consistent element from beginning to end is the 12 tribes of Israel. It's the only one. And people say, now why do you keep saying all this Israel stuff? Because God keeps saying all this Israel stuff. And I just think you're being purposefully foolish to ignore that, and wantingly rebellious to work against it, to say, no, no, it must mean something else. No, it must mean what it says, because it says it way too many times. Verse 22. Well, verse 21, we didn't quite finish that. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Every individual gate was one pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, as it were, transparent glass. So that's where you get the streets of gold from. And people, by the way, will say, heaven, streets of gold. Nowhere in the Bible does it say heaven, streets of gold. It says New Jerusalem, streets of gold. And that's where we get pearly gates from. People go, oh, St. Peter standing at the pearly gates. No, what there is are individual gates, 12 of them, and each gate made of an individual pearl. But it's not the entrance to heaven. It's the entrance to New Jerusalem. And yes, that would be a large pearl, would it not? Yeah. And I can't help, too, kind of making the connection just because Jesus, who could have picked any stone he wanted when he told the parable of the pearl of great price and said the man went and sold everything he had to get that one pearl of great price. I think, well, he could have picked anything. He could have said diamond of great price. Went with pearl. Interesting. Verse 22. And I saw no temple therein. Why would a Gentile care? Carol smiled. She got that. Why would John want to point out that there was no temple if he wasn't writing to people who were used to having a temple wherever God was? Why would he point out the lack of a temple? Because he's writing to Israelites and assuring them that they have a place in the New Jerusalem and that they each have a gate. I read one commentary that said the reason that there's 12 gates is that that's the gate by which each of those 12 tribes will be allowed to enter. The 12 tribes will be gathered. And by the way, I also can't help the fact that these 12 gates There's three on each side, which is the same way that the Israelites were laid out when they were in the wilderness. Every time the pillar of fire and smoke would stop and settle, they would set up the tabernacle in the wilderness, and then they would camp around the tabernacle by three on each side. And New Jerusalem comes with 12 gates, three on each side, where each of those 12 tribes can enter by their gate. And this is a God who knows what he's doing. So, I saw no temple therein, for the Lord God Almighty, look at the name he chose to use there. Lord God Almighty, that's the all-powerful God, the one who has the power to do whatever he wants, which when you see New Jerusalem coming, you'll go, yeah, that's power. The Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. What was the purpose of the temple? Yeah, what was the purpose? The place to worship God. That was the place where men went to meet with God. That's the place where atonement was made between man and God. That was the place where men went to worship God. You don't need a temple anymore. God's here. You don't need any kind of intermediary meeting place. God's here. He lives among his people. And both God and the Lamb are here. There's no need for a temple. There's no need for an altar. There's no need for a sacrifice. There's no need for any of that. They're here now. You're with them. That's why Jesus could say, it's done. All the leading up to it, that's all done. Now I will be their God. They will be my people. We will dwell together now. Isn't that exciting stuff? Doesn't that just get your imagination running and just go, man, that's just going to be. And do you realize that these promises are ours? This is family talk. This isn't telling the whole world, oh, you got a shot at this. This is God and his people. I will be their God. They will be my people. And the city has no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it, for the glory of God does lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. Now we're talking new heavens, new earth, aren't we? We've got a new earth with no sea, very different than anything we've imagined. And then we don't need a sun or a moon. So, new heavens. And God will lighten it, and the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it. And the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it. And the gates of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. Why did, when cities had gates, why did they close the gates?
Protection.
Protection. Keep the enemies out. Yeah, gates are wide open day and night. There's no enemies. And they shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it, and there shall in no wise enter into it anything that defiles, neither whatsoever works abomination or makes a lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life. Man, talk about bookends. I mean, when was the Lamb's book of life written? Before the foundation of the world, when God said, I think I'll do a thing. The stuff that Genesis starts with, in the beginning, God did this. We're talking about the in the beginning period. We're talking about God going, I'm going to write down some names, now let's make stuff. And then he began the whole process, and then you've got Jesus at the beginning of chapter 21 saying, it's done. And then you find that everybody he wrote down before he did anything ends up in the New Jerusalem in his glory forever. That's how sovereign the God of the Bible is, and I can't help the fact. I keep apologizing and saying I can't help the fact. But the reality is, the only God you find in the Bible is that sovereign. And the only story of salvation you find in the Bible is that story of salvation. And the only redemption you find in the Bible is the redemption that Christ gave to those people God wrote down before the foundation of the world. And there's no other way to tell the gospel. Well, there's plenty of other ways people are telling it. But there's no other biblical way to tell the gospel than to say God wrote down names he picked, he chose. Apparently for no good reason other than his own good pleasure, according to his own will, according to what he, God Almighty, chose to do. And he chose people, and those people are going to end up forever in his presence in the New Jerusalem so that he can be honored and praised and glorified by the people he chose. And that's the only gospel you find in the Bible. I like this contrast. There shall in no wise enter into it anything that defiles, or anything that works abomination or makes a lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life, they're the ones that enter. If I were God, I'd have the Lamb's Book of Life like laying out on display in the New Jerusalem. Yeah, so people could go up regularly and go, I'm right, look at me, I'm right in there. That's why I have a 14,000 square foot apartment. Have you seen the apartment? Because my name is right here. And he wrote it down before the foundation of the world. It's one thing when we see the judgment back in Revelation 20. And it says that the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the Lamb's Book of Life. And then everyone whose name was not found in the Lamb's Book of Life was thrown into the lake of fire. That's bad. I mean, when he's flipping through the book and your name isn't in there, that's really bad. But how eternally good is it to be able to go see your name written down in the Lamb's Book of Life, knowing that he wrote that down before the foundation of the world? Oh my goodness, how precious does that make you? That would never get boring. I'd be there every day just to make sure it was still there. There it is right there. There's that name. Before he did anything, he thought of me. When Christ hung on the cross, he had me in mind. I was on his shoulders and precious over his heart when he was there making that atonement as my high priest. Oh, yeah, that'll never get old. Especially when you're living in that kind of environment where you have open access to God. Whew. But that's the Christian goal. Again, I get so frustrated with the prosperity teaching or that stuff that says if God doesn't heal you, then you don't have enough faith or any of that. I want enough faith to get to go to the New Jerusalem. If I end up in New Jerusalem, I don't care how sick I was here. When you're about a million years into New Jerusalem, do you think you'll have any objection to the way God planned your life? You'll be going, you know the way you did it, God? That was the way to go. The pain, the trouble, the problems, all that, good plan. Everything about that, good plan. Because look at me now. And then, of course, he'll go, have you seen the book? You've seen your name. Wrote it down right here. Chapter 22, verse 1. And he showed me a pure river of the water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and the throne of the Lamb. That ought to make you think of Jesus saying moments ago, verse 6 of chapter 21, he said unto me, it is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. And now the angel shows it to John. Chapter 22, verse 1, he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. So from God's throne in New Jerusalem proceeds out a river of the water of life, and anyone who wants can go drink whenever they want. And that makes me think of Jesus standing up in the temple and saying, if any man is athirst, let him come to me. And in the midst of the street of it, and on either side of the river, there is a tree of life, which will bear 12 manner of fruits, and it yielded her fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. The tree of life, which Adam and Eve were forced out of the Garden of Eden so that they couldn't get to the tree of life anymore. It's very specific. No more access to the tree of life now that you're sinners. And we get to the New Jerusalem, and what do you find? The water, the river of the water of life, and the tree of life next to it. And whoever wants to gets to go eat of it. The restoration of everything God did with Adam and Eve comes to its fruition. And there will be, look at verse 3, and there shall be no more curse. What's the curse? The pain of childbirth. All that, the curse. Death. Yeah, absolutely. All of the curse for sin, everything that happens to humans, get old, die, pain in childbirth, men working with the sweat of their brow, all the curses that have come on men as a result of sin, gone, no more curse. Any curse you can think of, gone, no more curses. There will be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. And they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads. Isn't that remarkable? One of the things that I just mentioned about the high priest is that every time he went before God, he had to have a white turban on with a gold plate that said, Holiness to the Lord. And then When Jesus brought his model prayer and said, when you pray, pray like this, he started out with, Our Father which art in heaven, holy is your name. Holiness to the Lord. That's something God insists on hearing. Now he's going to put his name in the foreheads of all his people, which I do think, by the way, first off, you saw that with the 144,000. Now the servants of God come before him, have his name in their forehead, and that is the absolute opposite of those who had the mark in their right hand and in their forehead, the mark of the beast. Those that belong to God will have the name of God in their forehead, so that when he looks on them, he sees those that are his. They're marked as his. They have his name. And there should be no night there, and no need for a candle, neither light of the sun, for the Lord God giveth them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. I just don't know how to say more good news than that. That you're going to be part of that because God chose you before the foundation of the world. God wrote down your name, and everybody whose name is in the Lamb's Book of Life gets to go to the New Jerusalem. And in the New Jerusalem, you have open access to God, no more curse, water of life, tree of life. There's just no way to improve on that. And that's what God has intended for his people. And the remarkable part of that whole story is they're his people because he chose them to be his people. Not a one of them can say, I'm here because I did something. I chose. I decided. I exercised my free will. Everybody will be there because God chose them and wrote their name down and then bequeathed his love to them, not because they were good, but because he was so good and gracious that he chose himself a people. I just can't imagine that we will ever get tired of worshiping and glorifying that God, especially if we get to lay down this body of sin we have and the pride and the ego and the human arrogance that goes with it, and we're resurrected into new perfected bodies, sinless bodies that doesn't have all the crud running around in our heads that we have every day now. Imagine being able to worship in spirit and in truth, and God seeks such as those to worship him. He's going to get that. Because he's going to create that. And he's going to create it out of you and me. And take us there to worship him in spirit and in truth forever. And it'll never get old. It'll be great all the time. That's the goal of Christianity. So I think if we keep that focus, it's hard because we go, I'm headed for the New Jerusalem, but right now I'm working on my electric bill. So we get bogged down in this life. But just remember where you're headed. And that'll hopefully give you the strength to get up and go one more day. And maintain that faith, knowing that we're headed there. God's grace is taking you there, and boy, you can't lose. Any questions about that? Isn't that a great passage? How much fun is that?
Churches are making a big mistake by preaching this more often.
Oh, I think so.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, if you don't teach the book of Revelation and preach it, you're missing a huge blessing. John says it. That there's a blessing attached to this book and to everybody who reads it. And we'll get to that next week because I intend to finish the book of Revelation next week. And so, hey, I got a big chunk tonight. Do you know what Elizabeth said? Elizabeth said she heard me on the radio and then she said, you did so well at synopsizing those big chunks of information. That proves that you could have done this quicker than you did it.
Thank you for joining us for this week's study. We invite you back next week for another Salvation by Grace message.